I'm John Kroll. Today, on this special recorded No Limits, we're going to talk with Dr. Aaron Carroll. He has conducted an ongoing media campaign across media platforms to educate people about complicated questions of medical practice and basic health care. Because this is a recorded program, we're not going to be able to take your calls or questions via email or through social media, but we do hope that you will enjoy this discussion about matters that are important to all of us. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. This is a recorded No Limits, which means we're not going to be able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're going to enjoy the discussion. My guest today is Dr. Aaron Carroll, who has run an aggressive, in a good way, media campaign to educate people about healthcare matters and rather intricate questions of medical care. Welcome to the program, Dr.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly. So I want to start. I mean, you are in a lot of places right now.
Yes.
You're on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
You do podcasts.
Yep.
You write for the New York Times.
Pretty regularly.
Yeah. So you are, that sounds like a pretty much a full-time career all
you
by itself.
You would think, except it's like an eighth hobby. But it's, yes, I would say it constitutes a fairly large percentage, I think, of my waking hours at this point. And certainly, I think it's one of the most important things that I do. But ironically enough, it's probably not part of my real job.
So how did you get started doing it then?
So about a decade ago, healthcare reform was just starting to take off. President Obama was campaigning against John McCain at the time, and healthcare reform was really in the news. And I'm a health services researcher, which means that in addition to being a pediatrician, I have had extra training in research methodology, how to do research, but not on like, you know, not in a lab. I do research on the healthcare system. How can we improve the quality, cost, and access of the care that we receive? And as the debate for healthcare reform waged on, especially after the election, I was sometimes upset by the fact that we would have arguments about how we could reform health policy that seemed to accept the idea that we just can't know, that these are opinions about how different aspects or different methods of reform might affect the healthcare system. And as a researcher, it bothered me because I know that there's a lot of research that can inform how we could actually go about changing health policy. And so I started the blog back in the late 2008, 2009, that was the wild west, the era of blogging. Everybody seemed to have a blog.
And that was cutting edge at that point.
At the time, it was a thing. So I would sit down every morning and try to bang out one or two posts about what we could actually know from research about how healthcare reform might take place. And over time, I joined up with another blogger who lives in Boston, and we sort of merged into one big blog. And over time, the blog started to take off because other blogs and other more mainstream journalism outlets started to realize that we were a reasonably trustworthy source for what you might actually know from data and available evidence and research about what policy might do. And so the blog started to take off. As we moved into 2011 or 2012, some more traditional mainstream outlets came knocking at the door and saying, hey, would you write an op-ed here? Would you do so? I wrote a lot for CNN.com. And then in 2014, there was sort of this seismic shift in the blog world, especially when it comes to sort of policy, in that Ezra Klein, who was running Wonk Blog for The Washington Post, split off to form Vox. And Nate Silver, who was running 538.com for The New York Times, split off to have his own blog. And a lot of different media outlets at that point were trying to build their own sort of data journalism websites. And The New York Times started The Upshot. And we checked and basically asked them, cold called them, and said, do you want someone to write about health policy? And they said yes. And that's when I started writing for The New York Times back in 2014. At the same time, we started a YouTube show. So I don't think many people know this, but there is a major YouTube studio in Indianapolis proper. It's now called Complexly.com. Back then it was called EcoGeek. But they generate an enormous amount of educational YouTube content. The series Crash Course, and if you have a kid in high school these days, they watch Crash Course. About half of all its content is generated here in Indianapolis. The other half in Montana. It's basically John Green and Hank Green.
Mm-hmm.
John, of course, Green, a famous author.
Yeah, and he's been a guest on the show
great.
A couple of times.
So it's his YouTube studio. So they do a ton of educational content, and they were interested in starting up a show on healthcare and mm-hmm. health policy. And we met through the internet, and John asked if I'd be interested in doing that. And so me and Stan Muller and Mark Olson, with John's support and extra executive producing, have started making Healthcare Triage about the same time in 2014. And so we at this point generate about two episodes a week, usually, on very similar topics that I might write about at the New York Times. How can we use data and evidence and research to inform better thoughts about health or health policy? And then a couple years ago, we actually expanded into a podcast because some things you can't cover in a 4-minute, 5-minute, 6-minute video. They require longer form. And so for the last year or so, we've been focusing on more clinically through the podcast and trying to talk about what do we know about various disease processes or things about health. Can we talk to experts? Can we see what's going on with research? And of course, given that I work at Indiana University School of Medicine, it seemed natural to partner with them and our CTSI to try to talk about a lot of the research and clinical things that are going on in our own backyard and how they can inform what's going on nationally and in people's health.
I got to ask, given that medicine's not exactly a part-time occupation, where do you find the time to
do all
this?
It's one of those phantom toll booth type things. I try very hard not to think about it. If you don't know it's impossible, then maybe you can pull it off. So it's a great question. I think over time I've become more efficient. I mean, part of it was that, the blogging back in the day, I'd have to write so much every day to be a reasonable competitive blogger that you mm-hmm. get better at writing. I mean, just writing more efficiently. But it's also a lot of these things I can reuse the content. It's just for different audiences. If I'm doing the work to put out a New York Times column, I can sometimes take that and adapt it into a good healthcare triage script. And if I'm doing the same thing in reverse, it can sometimes help as well. I'd say that part of it is just it is what I love to do, and therefore I find the time, because I think at this point science communication has become one of the major parts of my career, even if it's not
the most lucrative.
No, it's certainly absolutely not. People ask all the time, why don't you do this full time? And I'm like, well, I like my real job too. It's working for the university, doing research. I run a lot of the mentorship, or I direct a lot of the mentorship and educational endeavors through the medical school for faculty. And I love that work. So it just, as long as, one of the great things for working for IU School of Medicine is they've allowed me the freedom to do all of these things, and I appreciate it.
So how do you, when you're working on these things, whether it is a New York Times column or whether it's Healthcare Triage or doing the podcast, how do you select which parts? Because, healthcare,
right.
If you're thinking about it, it's what, 20% of the American economy? It's, just this huge thing that touches almost every part of human life. How do you decide, which door or window you're going to enter in there to talk about?
Things come up a number of different ways. I'd say the most common is, I at this point pay pretty close attention to the medical literature, what new studies or new research is being published. And then when I see a paper that I think is important or a research piece that I think is important, I'm not a journalist in the traditional sense, and the mm-hmm. idea that I need to break that story and write about it the day that it comes out, which mm-hmm. is what the vast majority of journalists, I think, are doing, even at the New York Times. So I have the freedom to say, okay, well, this is an interesting piece that's coming out, but I think what we really need to do is sit back, look at the rest of the literature, talk about what we know before this paper came out. How do we place it in context? What does it mean for us? That takes time, and it mm-hmm. takes a fairly decent level of knowledge about how research works and how medicine works that I think most journalists just can't do. So I will at that point pitch it to my editors and say, I think there's a larger piece here. Mm-hmm. I think we could talk about how this might change our thinking, or why this study is the news is getting it wrong, or, you know, why it's totally been missed and we really need to pay attention to it. And I can then take the time to go through it more thoroughly. Once in a while, it's from a news hook. You know, something is really in the news, and then I will work very hard to try to get a more informed piece out as quickly as possible. But I'd say the vast majority of what I write, you know, comes out a month, 2 months, 3 months after the major news story broke, to try to talk about why I think the news got it right or wrong, and to try to do a more thorough job in explaining why people should or should not care about what they heard.
If you are just joining us, this is a special recorded No Limits. We're talking with Dr. Aaron Carroll, who has a small educational media empire now when it comes to healthcare matters. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So I understand why you got into this, when healthcare emerged as it was going to be huge debate. At what point did you know you were going to continue doing it, though? Because it's, you know, from 2008 to 2014 is this six-year period. Were you getting feedback from people saying this is helpful to me? Or, you know, what led you to stay in there? Because it's an awful lot of time and energy.
So our blog had a reasonable readership, but the numbers were never so much that we were going to build our own empire or start making real money off of it. But we had a very concentrated readership. The mm-hmm. percentage of healthcare journalists that read our blog was incredibly high. The percentage of legislators that read mm-hmm. our blog was very high. We would get feedback all the time from people in Washington on committees talking about healthcare reform, said like, yeah, you know what, they read our blog or they pay attention to what we were talking about. We also knew that a fairly large number of academics were reading our blog, and it provided a window and a way for us to talk about research that we thought was important that otherwise wouldn't see the light of day. I mean, the part of the problem was that a lot of this health policy research, no one ever knew about it. It just mm-hmm. wasn't sexy. The things that people care about for the most part are you going to save my life tomorrow with respect to medical research, not how do we reform the healthcare system. So we felt like we were talking to a very specific but important audience in ways that other traditional media were not. Also, we found that we could leverage our position to get more mainstream media to talk about things. That if we spent a week talking about why it's bad to raise the retirement age for Medicare on the blog, there would be much more prestigious and well-read editorialists who would then maybe write mm-hmm. about it. We used to have a game. We try to see, can we get Paul Krugman to, you know, write about this topic this week?
Yeah.
or at the time, you know, Tyler Cowen was very big, or Andrew Sullivan. And so we knew that we had leverage, that even if this wasn't a way to become famous or to sort of really get out there ourselves, that we could help maybe make the policy discussion better. And that was totally worth our time. It did not hurt, I think, that this opened doors for us, me and Austin Fracht, who did our mm-hmm. blog together, to reach experts and researchers and even legislators that otherwise would never have given us the time of day, that it became a platform for us to make connections and try to broaden this world of health research and health policy in ways that perhaps wasn't happening. And it, we hoped, was going to draw other researchers or people interested in health into the light, that they might be interested in doing this as well, because we need more people doing this in the field, more experts who are willing to bridge the gap between, you know, the ivory tower of health research and what the lay public reads or hears about every day. So it was certainly filling a need. And I'd also say that new things seemed to come along every couple of years, whether it was, you know, writing for other media mm-hmm. organizations or the YouTube show or the New York Times. It just kept seeming to gain momentum and grow, and that was incredibly exciting and an opportunity that we just weren't willing to give up.
Which media platform did you find the most difficult to adapt to?
The New York Times was steep learning curve, partially because I'd never really been edited before. I mean, one of the things about having a blog is I could just write something and hit go and it was there, and I could change it whenever I wanted. Writing for the Times is different because, one, lots of people take a whack at it before it sees the light of day, and then once it's there, it's done. I still go back periodically and edit blog posts that I wrote a decade ago. They're mine. But I can't do that at the New York. That just can't happen at the New York Times. You got to get it right the first time.
And did you find the transition to video or doing the podcast relatively easy?
That wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. You know, of course, you have to get Stan and Mark and John in here to talk about whether or not I was any good at it at the beginning. But I feel like that wasn't as hard. I think partially because I'd done a fairly large amount of radio, especially during healthcare reform and on it. So I'd spoken to live audiences for a long time, and I was reasonably good at sort of crafting a, you know, soundbite argument, or at least in a few minutes, and that translated very well into video.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Dr. Aaron Carroll about his media education efforts on healthcare questions. This is a recorded No Limits, which means that we're not able to take calls, emails, or deal with questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the discussion. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today in this special recorded No Limits with Dr. Aaron Carroll, who's done some fascinating things in terms of educating people about healthcare and medical questions, particularly policy and public policy questions, through basically every media platform there is out there. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take questions or comments via email, phone, or social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So I want to talk a little bit because about you know, the, sort of the larger arena in which all of this is taking place, because it does seem like one of the reasons it has been successful and it's found, you know, both a targeted audience and then a broader audience, is that we are in one of those shifts where we're thinking differently about healthcare and about medicine. Watching and listening to some of your work, I've noticed that a lot of it is about, okay, you, meaning not you personally, sure, but all of us collectively, need to take more responsibility for our own healthcare, for our own wellness, and that, you know, for lack of a better term, I think it's a more proactive approach to taking care of ourselves rather than, you know, the earlier concepts of medicine. We wait until someone gets sick and then we deal with that.
Well, there's that, and I think it's also an issue of, I think many people assume that doctors and medicine have got it all figured out, that there's a special knowledge that one absorbs in all the years of medical education and residency and practice, that there are definitive answers to all the questions that are out there. And one of the things that has been, I think, why I got into research to begin with, but why the beginning of my practice was so frustrating, is that we don't definitively know nearly as much as people think. And that even, I would say, a good portion of my columns these days are devoted to the idea of, like, we've been saying this for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and now, oh, God, we're just not sure, yeah, especially when it comes to things like food. And so part of it is to – it is perfectly appropriate, I think, when we as physicians or we as doctors know with reasonable certainty what is right or wrong, that we tell people this is what you should do. Mm. But when we do not have that surety, then there's a lot more – flexibility or personal preference into what people might want to do. And that's not often, I think, how medicine is practiced. People should probably have more of a say into many aspects of their health care, because a lot of it is preference. It's, mm-hmm, it is based on what might be more important to you. And that is a very
Could
different way
me,
of thinking.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to interrupt on that, but I think that's an important point when you say it's preference. Could you give me an example?
Sure.
A context, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, everything should be, whenever you're thinking about what you might want to do in terms of your health, it's important to be thoughtful about what are the benefits that I might receive and what are the harms that I might receive, and then to weigh those and decide what to do. And so we can go through a period. I mean, if we're going to talk about men, let's take prostate screening, for example, where we didn't do it. Then all of a sudden, mm-hmm, it was, well, everybody should do it. And now, to be very honest, it really has moved for the vast majority of men into a preference-sensitive decision of, mm-hmm, you know, these are the benefits that you might get from it, and we can quantify that in terms of, for every 1,000 men screened, how many actually might see their lives saved. And it's ironically enough very, very small. And then we can say, what are the harms you might receive? And we can say that for every 1,000 men screened, a significant number, far more, are going to have a bad outcome in the sense that, like, they might wind up getting radiation or surgery and then becoming impotent or becoming incontinent. And it's a larger number. It is perfectly reasonable to decide that you don't care, that life saving is so important that you would rather get that screening and go through with it. It's perfectly reasonable to say, you know what, the absolute risk reduction is so low and the potential for harm is so high that I don't want to be screened. And both of those decisions are perfectly rational. And both of them should be based upon what patients want. That is not often how decisions are made in medicine, where it is more that it's much more up to the physician. Well, I think you should be all men should be screened, all men should be not screened. I could have this discussion about mammograms and breast cancer. I could have this discussion about colon cancer, although the numbers are much more clear there. But there's many decisions that might be more preference sensitive to what people might want. With respect to diet, it used to be that we were sure low fat was the way to go. These days, man, it is not known. And all kinds of diets are okay. And a much more thoughtful approach to there's a wide variety of ways to eat that could all be considered healthy under what we know from science, as opposed to being very prescriptive and saying we know what is the same and what is right or wrong for everybody. I could do this all day. I mean, it's like you can almost pick anything. And I could say, well, you know, it turns out we don't know nearly as much as we think. And therefore, it's okay for people to take a wide variety of attitudes and make a wide variety of decisions. Ironically enough, the stuff that we're pretty sure about is basic, not nearly as severe as what people think, but yet still would make an enormous difference in people's lives, and still too few people do it.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Dr. Aaron Carroll about his attempts to use media to educate people about complicated healthcare questions. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. We hope you're enjoying the conversation. So I want to talk a bit about the thing that sort of gave life to this initiative of yours, the emergence of the great healthcare debate and the fact that, you know, we're now, what, 11 years into
it? Oh, God, I can't tell you.
And it hasn't really gone away. I've talked to several doctors over the years, and they're from vastly different points on the ideological, political spectrum. But they're saying, if nothing else that has come out of this, it has forced us to start having conversations about a lot of these things. It's forced us to deal with a lot of questions that people just didn't want to deal with before.
I think there's some truth to that. I do, but I'm also, I think at the same time, utterly dismayed that we're still having the same arguments to some extent that we were having almost a decade ago.
Well, and are they false arguments, false choices?
To some extent, yes. But the bigger problem is that I think that they prevent us from having the much more real conversation. I mean, almost all of the fights we've been having for the last 12 years have been about how do we provide more people with health insurance. They're almost 100% centered around access. And not only that, ironically enough, they're about how do we get a rather small percent of the population insurance. The vast majority of people still, or no, I shouldn't say, the majority of people still have employer-based health insurance. On top of that, a significant number still have Medicare. There's some small percentage of the VA. And so we're left with the percent that's covered by Medicaid, which certainly has gone up. In fact, it's probably doubled. And then what is left are the people who get insurance on the individual market, people either who are self-employed or don't get insurance through their jobs. At the end of the day, the number of people truly affected by the Affordable Care Act is probably between 30 and 45 million. That's 10% of the U.S. population. I mean, it's not everyone. We're still reforming this one small segment of the – and we're fighting about it still. And the fact that we're still so fixated on fighting about access means that we've never turned to cost or quality, which are the other two pillars of the healthcare system, both of which are much harder to fix than access. I could fix access tomorrow. I could fix it in any number of ways.
How would you fix it?
So that's a great question. And if you're asking me, is Aaron Carroll God Emperor, might...
I'm going to give you divine powers.
I would probably... So I would probably... completely change our healthcare system into something that looked more like, let's say, Switzerland, where because I think it would be the most palatable to us, where we would do away with employer-based health insurance. Everybody would buy insurance on their own. We would probably do away with Medicare and Medicaid. We would have all the insurance provided on a nonprofit or for-profit basis, from birth to death, from well-regulated companies, where the nonprofit side would be very tightly regulated. It would be like the Affordable Care Act, almost the exchanges writ large across the entire country. Back in the day, there was a proposal called Wyden-Bennett, which was from Senator Wyden, who's a relatively left-leaning guy, and Senator Bennett, who was from Utah, who at the time was a relatively right-leaning guy. Mm. And they had this well-documented or well-written, enormous plan that was supported by senators from both sides of the aisle. It was about as bipartisan as you could get that would do what I'm describing. And it failed miserably because we don't like change. And the idea that we would upend our entire healthcare system would do that. But that would provide something along the order of Switzerland. But there are lots of ways you could reform. You could reform it Canada style, which would be Medicare basically for all for the most part. You could do it France style, which would be, you know, less than Medicare for all, and then a private-based system for anyone that wanted it on top of it, where the vast majority of people would still get that. You could do it any number. I mean, there's lots of different ways to do it. We just keep fighting to not do almost anything. I mean, there's just a real bias for the status quo here. But that keeps us, again, from really tackling cost, which is a major problem
and
going
quality.
Forward, and quality, which is the problem going forward. I mean, what we really care about is delivery system reform. Mm. What we really care about is how do we make healthcare better, not how do we get everybody insurance. We want people to be healthy. We don't have that discussion nationally almost ever because we're still fighting about how do we move the money and the paper pushing from left to right and right to left in order to get people health insurance, which is necessary but not sufficient to really improving the healthcare system.
Does the access question, though, in addition to kind of overwhelming the other two discussions that you want to have about cost and quality, also to some degree derail or affect the way we deal with those? Because, you know, at least the cliche, and we often hear spouted when this is that we spend more on healthcare, and you know, and actually, you know, obviously the people at the top end get some of the best care available, but a lot of other people don't.
No, absolutely.
And all of that.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I give talks all the time. Our access is abysmal compared to almost any other country. Our costs are by far the most expensive in the world, and our quality is middling. It is not at best. I mean, you can cherry pick a statistic or a population to prove that we are number one at something. We're very good at breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
We're very good at prostate cancer. We're reasonably good at, we're terrible at lung cancer. Problem is, more people die of lung cancer than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined. But we don't talk about lung cancer because we want to focus on the things we're good at. And we can beat this country or that country, but we don't beat all of the countries. And when you sort of put all the metrics together, we perform much more poorly than you might expect. And that's ridiculous, given that we spend more than everybody else and that we don't give everybody access. So a good healthcare system would try to maximize one of those three things. You would want to be best at access or quality or cost, maybe two of them. You can't be the best at all three because just simple economics says you can't be cheap and universal and awesome. Like, it's just, it's not. You can be awesome and expensive. You can be universal and you can't do all three. So the problem is we're doing basically none. And that's an irrational healthcare system. And we've chosen, for the most part, to fixate on access because it's the one that feels the most unfair, I think. But in some ways, it's also the easiest to fix. I could snap my fingers tomorrow and we could have Medicare for everybody and we would solve the access issue. We would not yet have solved the cost or the quality issue, but we could solve the access issue tomorrow. We could also go with, again, more of a Wyden-Bennett. We go with an entirely private. There are lots of ways we can see across the world to universally solve healthcare. We know we can do it. We just won't.
Well, let's break it down then. First, I'm going to ask you if you, again, you can't solve all three of them, which ones would you, again, using your divine powers that we've granted you for the purposes of this discussion, Which one or two or three, would you prioritize?
I choose access first because it's the easiest, and it also makes things fair, and I think it gives us at that point a platform with which to attack the other two. Without access, it's very hard to bring the levers to bear to fix the other two. And of the other two, I would choose quality. And the reason for that is that we're very rich, mm-hmm. and we are okay, clearly, spending a fortune. We could just spend it more efficiently. So given that I don't think anyone in the U.S. has an aim to be the cheapest healthcare system in the world, and we've already just owned we're going to be by far the most expensive, we could then focus on trying to fix the other two.
And how would we go about it? What are some practical steps? So here? We're not going to be able to get all of this in before the break, but we will pick it up if we have to on the other.
So I think probably, and again, this it's funny, too, because people say, well, what would you do if you were president? My joking answer is nothing, because the president can't do this. You need to make me king. And if you make me king. I think the number one thing we could do is stop spending money on things that don't work. We have tons of examples of things that are just waste. My favorite example of this is in the early 2000s, the number one procedure prescribed in the United States, the number one procedure done in the United States was arthroscopic surgery of the knee for osteoarthritis. Basically, when you had severe knee pain, the doctors would make a little hole. They'd go in there with these tools, and they would sort of clean out your knee and then sew you back up. Hugely popular. It was the number one procedure performed. Then there was a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think in 2003, that randomized people with osteoarthritis to get one of three things. They didn't know which they got. They got the arthroscopic surgery. Second was a lavage, which basically means they flush it out with a needle. And the third was they cut the people open, they twiddled their thumbs for 20 minutes, they sewed it up, and then told them they'd had arthroscopic surgery in the knee. I mean, it's borderline unethical. But they had the exact same results, which proved that the surgery did nothing above placebo effect. And people, of course, lost their minds. They repeated this study again, probably more ethically, where they randomized people to get surgery or, you know, very cheap physical therapy. Again, the same results. They proved arthroscopic surgery of the knee does not work for osteoarthritis. It is still a procedure that costs us about a couple billion dollars a year, probably from Medicare. And so we just do it. We know it doesn't work. We've proven it doesn't work. We do it. I could rattle you off. I wrote a column for the Times and just there have been the 20 or 30 surgical procedures which have been studied by randomized controlled trials. About half of them turn out not to work. And still we do this. And then, you know, you have something called like choosing wisely, which is an entire campaign which almost every medical specialty has contributed to, the gist of which is each specialty has to come up with at least five, but sometimes 10 or 15 things that they know doctors should never do and still do, and we pay for it. If we stopped doing stuff that didn't work or refused to pay for it, that was low-hanging fruit, and we could save, you know, it's thought that there's hundreds of billions of dollars of what we would consider waste in the sense that it doesn't improve outcomes. The problem is that one man's waste is another man's income. Yeah. And that it's not that we take that money and burn it in a pile. All of that money is, you know, it goes into the healthcare system and it goes into the economy and it keeps the wheels turning and it pays not just for doctor's salaries, but it pays the rent and it pays nurses' salaries and it pays, you know, the people that clean the floors of the hospital and it pays the companies. It spends a lot of money. It's very hard to pull that back, which is why I'd say what we could do is not spend less, which, you know, would be a real issue, but spend better. And if we started shifting money from things that don't work into things perhaps that we thought might or might actually provide good to people, that would raise quality. That would improve outcomes. But that would be very difficult to do, and it would probably have to be reasonably heavy-handed.
Yeah, and I'm assuming there are probably also other motivations besides,
holding
on another person's income. It's also,
People want to do stuff. They think stuff helps. They don't want to do nothing. And so it is absolutely human that if left with two choices of I'm going to do nothing or I'm going to do something, that people choose something. It's also very human to know somebody was sick, I did something, they got better. Therefore, I think that the something caused the getting better. It takes very careful study to say, well, those are true, but unrelated. And it's not only is it hard to study, it's hard to make that information percolate back into the consciousness, which again gets us back to media. Part of what I'm trying to do is it's thought that there's about a 15 to 17 year lifespan between what we learn in the literature and eventually getting into practice. I want to shorten that.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Dr. Aaron Carroll about his efforts to use multiple media platforms to educate people about complicated healthcare and medical questions. This is a recorded program, so we're not taking questions or comments by phone, email, or social media, but we hope you're enjoying the discussion. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today in this recorded No Limits with Dr. Aaron Carroll about his ongoing campaign to educate people about difficult, sometimes complicated questions dealing with health care and medicine through many media platforms. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take questions or comments by phone, by email, or through social media. But we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So we were talking about, before we went to the break, about this larger question of how you enhance quality. One way you said is to just sounds relatively simple. Stop doing things that we know don't work. Are there other ways?
I think one of the ways we could do a better job is partially through if everyone had a better understanding of what constituted good health and what might make a difference. And partially that would be doing things that we know matter and also stopping doing things that don't matter so much. So, I mean, what are those things? So, you know, it's funny, but, you know, lifestyle changes matter. Lifestyle does matter. I mean, we know that. But the thing is that I think people don't get what really matters with respect to lifestyle changes, like what would actually make a difference. And there's a couple things that have been well studied and well pushed, but they're not nearly as severe as people think. So what are they? Don't smoke. You know, smoking cigarettes, no brainer, don't do it. Don't drink too much alcohol. No more than moderate drinking, which most people still say, I think, for a man is about 14 drinks a week, and for a woman is about 7 drinks a week. But obviously, it goes up or down a little bit based on body size and everything else. Eat a reasonably healthy diet. What do I mean by that? You know, there's all kinds of ways to quantify that, but not too much saturated fat, not too much of any one food group. Don't overdo the carbs. Clearly watch the calories to some extent. Not really large amounts of processed food. Just do a decent job. Exercise. But exercise doesn't mean run a marathon. It means 30 minutes of moderate activity a day, 5 days a week. So we're talking about 150 minutes of moderate activity. Moderate activity can be brisk walking. You know, you don't need to run. You don't need to go to the gym. A good, solid, brisk walk, 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, gets you all the benefits that we've proven exist. Doing those things and those things alone gets you the vast majority of benefits that we know you'll get from lifestyle changes. And those benefits are massive. They can overcome even genes or lots of things that are hereditary. And that has to do with heart disease. It can even have things to do with cancer. I mean, lifestyle differences matter. Taking care of yourself matters, but it's not the extreme. And I think too many people watch shows with extreme diets or things that they need to run a triathlon or think that they need to get a trainer and spend an hour at the gym really killing them. None of that matters. What you eat matters so much more often than the exercise. So that would make a difference. I think not paying attention to so many fads or silver bullets that people think are the way that they're going to jury-rig the system or somehow circumvent it and get these health gains that aren't there. Supplements don't work. You know, crazy diets don't work. Extreme activity doesn't work. Cleanses don't work. We don't need this stuff. Simple, thoughtful moderation gets you most of the way there. In the same way, I think with respect to the more concrete practice of medicine, the fact that we don't need to make drastic changes for a variety of things. Now, of course, you know, if you have cancer, yes, chemotherapy works. You know, for drastic things, the drastic interventions are necessary. But the vast majority of us don't have those things. We have much more simpler, chronic, but yet smaller problems that often require smaller changes in health. But we attack things with huge amounts of attention in short bursts that are often very expensive and unfortunately don't work very well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Aaron Carroll about ways that we can better understand health care and medicine, particularly in policy implications. It's a recorded program, so we're not taking calls or emails or messages via social media. Hope you're enjoying the conversation, though. So, you know, the stuff, and you've done so much that I've got to admit, I haven't read or watched it
all. Oh, that's no problem.
All of that. But it struck me that, you know, one of the themes, if there is an overarching theme to what you're doing here, it is, you know, providing information, creating tools for people to be more knowledgeable consumers, owners, really, of their own health. I'd like for you to talk a little bit about what pieces of that are the most difficult to break down and explain, because one of the things that impressed me is you do a really good job. You said you hadn't had journalistic training or whatever, but you could have fooled me.
Oh, thank you.
Because, you know, you do a really good job of breaking things down to their components and explaining them in ways that people who haven't gone to medical school for more than half a dozen years and all of that still can follow along.
So I think that the things that are hardest for people to grasp fall into just a few different categories. One is to understand the difference between what we call relative risk and absolute risk. So people say all the time red meat causes cancer. And the truth of the matter is that that link is not proven. It is still – there's an association. Some people think it is causal, but it's still an association. But even then – the idea is that it's not actually just all red meat. It turns out it's really processed red meat, which is a smaller subset. And even if you believe it, the association that we see is 18%. That's
probably, and I should step in here real quickly and just ask you, for people who haven't gone to medical school, the difference, what is processed red meat?
So processed red meat is like bacon or salami. Or, you know, so it's like it's a steak is just red meat. I mean, basically the butcher cut it, handed to you, cooked it.
Yeah.
Meat that's processed is like bacon. It's been cured. Lots of things have been added to it to make it last longer, it tastes different. So it has other chemicals and things in it. But the association says 18% increased risk. That's a relative risk. And that sounds very scary. But what we need to know is that we really need to care about the absolute risk. So if I go to the National Cancer Institute website and I plug in all the stuff about Aaron Carroll and I said I was 50 because it starts at 50, it turns out my lifetime risk of getting colon cancer is something I'm going to make up a number, but it's about 2.5%. Because it's a relative risk, that means if I commit to eating an extra 3 pieces of bacon every day for the rest of my life, which I'm not going to do, but if I did, then my risk would go up 18%. Means it goes from like 2.5% to like 2.8%, like or 2.9. It's a very small change, and that's if I commit to eating 3 pieces of bacon every day for the rest of my life. And even then, it's not proven. Like those are much smaller numbers, but we panic people because we focus on the relative risk, not the absolute risk. Almost every scary news story you've ever read is talking about the relative risk. The second thing is that you have to weigh both sides of the story. The number one killer of children in the United States by far is accidents. It's car accidents by far. And yet there are never news stories saying like we have to all stop driving because kids are dying. We are perfectly rational and can accept that a certain number of children are going to die every year. And we're okay with that because cars are great. And cars also serve a lot of good, and they improve our lives in many ways that make it okay for there to be a certain – like we can accept the benefits and the harms. But when it comes to many medical news stories, we won't do that. We can only see the harm. And so we will focus on one side or the other without fully understanding that like some of these things actually make life better in other ways. Sometimes that better is joy. Sometimes that better is cost. Sometimes that better is even better health in other areas. But if we only focus on one thing, we get the whole story wrong. You see that, you know, California is, you know, passing laws right now that basically say they have to put up in stores that coffee causes cancer because it contains acrylamide. And acrylamide, they think, causes cancer in rats. And it takes, of course, vast, you know, amounts of acrylamide. The truth of the matter is that acrylamide is not an industrial additive. It occurs anytime you cook starch. So like 40% of our calories contain acrylamide. You make toast, you made acrylamide. You know, you make bread, you made acrylamide. You roast coffee, you made acrylamide. Acrylamide has been in coffee since the beginning of time. Coffee, on the other hand, has been shown in study after study after study after study to be associated with great health outcomes. So by focusing on this chemical, which has never really been proven to cause cancer in humans, that we can't take out of the food even if we wanted to, scares people in a way that distracts them and doesn't let them fully understand what real dangers are, and yet also might convince them not to drink something that might actually confer a health benefit, but more importantly, might provide some level of joy, which is not a good way to live. If we live in fear of everything, we will enjoy nothing. And unfortunately, when it comes to health, we often just focus on one side or the other without really getting everything into balance about what does it mean in terms of benefits and harms and across the spectrum. We're always, again, remembering that joy is a benefit. You know, being happy is a benefit.
Well, given that that there are a lot of these things, and I agree with you, actually, that a lot of the reporting is designed to frighten us and all of that. So we're preconditioned to think of these. What area do you find the most difficult to cut through that sort of natural fear response and get people to take a deep breath and look at what the facts are? Because that's the other sort of element of what you're trying to do here is, okay, let's take some of the emotion out of this,
right,
and just talk about what the facts are so we can make a rational assessment.
I think the hardest thing for people to grasp is that not everything has a known cause and effect. It just, you know, just happens. When there was a recent study last year about alcohol and cancer, and it said, like, for each drink that you take, the number of people that'll have a negative effect goes up. But what people don't get is that more people will have an effect even if they drink nothing. You know, a lot of people who drink no alcohol ever will have one of these bad consequences. There's nothing they can do. Just is going to happen. And a number of people are going to drink a ton and have no bad effect. It's just nothing we can do. What we care about is that middle, but that middle is very small. But unfortunately, what happens is that people say, oh, God, I got cancer. It's because I drank alcohol. Or if you drink alcohol, you're going to get cancer. When that's not known, it's like the vast majority of people, it just doesn't matter. But we don't live life that way. We assume that everything that happens is someone's fault or they could have done something differently. And that's not always true. And we shouldn't overreact and we shouldn't, you know, make drastic changes, I think, all of the time when the effects might not be nearly as big as we think they will be.
Is some of that maybe taking you out of the area we're talking about, but it also, as you were describing that, thinking that, oh, okay, well, if I don't do this and I don't do that, it gives us an illusion that we can control, and that there just are not things here in life that are beyond our control that we simply have to accept.
Yes, and I think that part of it is that, and we want to do something, but I think the larger thing that we don't grasp all the time and that we refuse to grasp is how much of this is social determinants of health. And that, you know, the number one predictor of living a long life in the United States is how much money you make or how wealthy the area in which you live is. Number by far. One of the things we focus on at IU all the time is we keep talking about this Mon on Trail project we're working on, where if you just take the Mon on Trail, at one end, life expectancy is like 15 to 16 years greater than at the other end. Zip code matters. The services available matters. So much of this is determined that has nothing to do with, you know, whether or not you're eating gluten or, you know, what supplements you're taking or do you go to that yoga class. It has to do, unfortunately, with the structures of society and how some things are built and inequality. And there are things which are harder to tackle that probably have an enormous impact on health. But we don't have that conversation too often. We just focus on health things for health. And unfortunately, a lot of that stuff we can't fix with medicines. I see a lot of problems in clinic that I can't solve with a prescription pad that would require larger structural changes or the willingness of all of us to sort of come to grips with the idea that there are larger issues that have an enormous impact on health that we seem very unwilling to change.
If you could change one of those, pick one issue, the one that is sort of the linchpin.
I think
I'm asking you this question. We've only got like 3 minutes left.
I think there's a reasonable amount of evidence that actually, income inequality has an enormous amount to do with health. That ironically enough, it's not often even are you in a rich zip code or a poor zip code. If you are a poorer person in a richer zip code, that's almost the worst thing that can be.
Yeah.
Because there aren't a lot of services in that zip code, given that people are well off, and then you're even more out of luck. Often, you know, zip codes that are almost universally poor, we at least focus attention there. The problem is inequality, and that's It's hard to fix. It's hard to study. It's hard to get around. But that can make an enormous difference in a lot of the things that we worry about with respect to trying to get people to live longer, happier, healthier lives.
So that, you know, in that way, medicine is also, that's a political, cultural thing.
Oh, it's hard. Absolutely.
And do you have any faith at all that our system is going to be able to cope with that?
I like to think that we're heading in the right direction. I mean, at least these conversations are happening. I think we are talking more about social determinants of health. We're recognizing these things matter more and more often. We're seeing a lot of studies which are confirming this. That at least provides the data and the evidence needed for people to then make better arguments about what we can do about it, which, of course, is hard because we could just throw money at it, but that doesn't necessarily solve the problem in the most efficient manner. We want to get the most bang for the buck as possible, and that requires careful thought as to how we might improve some of these problems.
So in the years you've been doing this now, do you have a favorite piece that you've done, or the one where you thought, oh, God, I really nailed that one?
There's been a couple. They're almost all ones which I think I write almost in reaction and anger. I think I think the one that I wrote in response to the alcohol and cancer article was some of my best writing in terms of explaining about the minimal absolute risks. I wrote a column years ago which was about would I rather my kids try alcohol or pot someday, which is a hard conversation to have because the answer is neither, of course. You know, if you're going to be honest about it, that I'm still pretty proud of that one that's out there. And then I think there are a couple where I've taken reasonably complex, scary problems, and I try to use numbers to explain to people how better to think about them, and those are good. We've also done on the YouTube show, we did a whole series on countries' healthcare systems and how they differ that I still think is some of our best educational work. It provides people, a nice snapshot, 6-7 minutes, to understand what do each of these healthcare systems do well and not well. And it's not just socialism and us.
Yeah.
There's huge numbers of ways to do this, as we talked about with Switzerland. I think that provided a good way for people to sort of get a good grasp of how there are lots of different systems out there.
Is that frustrating for you that so many of these discussions are either ors?
Yes.
As a whole,
Oh, my gosh. In other words, like, it's what you're either for or against it. And it's like, well, there's a whole range in there. Especially when it comes to healthcare reform, it's incredibly frustrating because people think there's like freedom and tyranny.
Yeah.
And then there's us and them. And the truth of the matter is that there are healthcare systems out there that are more conservative than ours and that are more liberal than ours. And so why are we not looking to them to see what can we do better or what could we do worse in trying to figure out the difference? There are trade-offs. There are always trade-offs. We don't recognize that often.
And that's, I think, a good last word for us to stop on. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Aaron Carroll, for what's been a lively conversation about being better informed and educated about questions of healthcare and medicine. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.